Good morning. First case of the morning to be heard would be Repa v. Roadway Express. Mr. DiNardo.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Larry DiNardo. I represent Roadway Express. This is an appeal from the district court's decision holding that Roadway violated the Family and Medical Leave Act by substituting Repa's accrued vacation time and sick days for part of the time she was on FMLA leave. The district court ordered Roadway to restore the accrued vacation days and sick days that had been designated by Roadway as FMLA days. The narrow issue is whether Roadway had the right under what are referred to as the substitution provisions of the FMLA to designate the 3 weeks that Repa had accrued of vacation and sick days as part of her FMLA leave. Because the plain language of the statute of the FMLA makes such a substitution allowable, and because such a substitution is consistent with the structure of the Act and the policies of the Act, the district court's judgment should be reversed. The basic leave provision in the FMLA provides that eligible employees shall be entitled to a total of, and this is the language of the basic provision, a total of 12 work weeks of leave in any 12-month period for various medical and family reasons. Here the reason was the employee's own serious medical condition. But the basic provision uses the language a total of 12 work weeks of leave. Doesn't speak in terms of paid or unpaid. The statute also includes a substitution, a so-called substitution provision, which in the case of leave relating to an employee's own serious health condition, provides that an employee may elect or an employer may require the employee to substitute any accrued paid vacation or paid sick leave for any part of the 12 work weeks of leave provided under the basic provision of the Act. In effect, you transform what would otherwise be vacation into part of the 12-week period provided under the Family and Medical Leave Act. If you are an employee with zero accrued paid vacation, the federal statute says you must be given up to 12 weeks of leave. If you're an employee with 12 accrued weeks of paid vacation, the Act allows an employer, doesn't require, but allows the employer to convert, if you will, those 12 weeks of paid leave into your entire allotment of family and medical leave.
Now, if this employee had, let's say, broken her ankle on the last day of her vacation and then comes back, and she's already used the vacation, and let's say hypothetically she used her sick leave or something else, now she goes on FMLA. Obviously, there's no option for an employer to do anything about that, I assume.
That's right, Your Honor. Nor for her. She has already received her vacation pay. She's used the time. The employer in that period, starting with that event, must provide her 12 weeks of Family and Medical Leave Act over the course of the next 12-month period. So the accommodation reached in Congress was to not add to the period of absence where an employer is already providing paid absences beyond a combined 12-week period. In your example, though, since she had no accrued leave remaining at the time she applied for FMLA leave, she'd be entitled, assuming she hadn't taken any otherwise, she'd be entitled to 12 full weeks.
And if there's some benefit, I guess this was sort of an external benefit. Was this from the union insurance?
There's a multi-employer Taft-Hartley plan that provided her with disability benefits. Actually, those benefits would have run not just for the 12-week period, but for an additional 14 weeks, a total of 26 weeks from a employer union provided multi-employer plan. She could have had her own disability insurance, et cetera. She could have received a variety of benefits. The regs provide that if there is funds coming to someone on leave, an employer is not entitled to the substitution provision, nor is the employee entitled to elect to treat part of her 12 weeks as her paid vacation. And that's the point of all of
this appeal. As I understand, this is entirely a matter of statutory construction.
Entirely, Your Honor. It's simply a matter of the plain language of the statute and determining whether or not the Congress has spoken on this subject unequivocally, thereby foreclosing a restriction of this right by the Department of Labor.
I was just modestly curious. Well, I'm honestly curious why it requires all this conversation, but go ahead.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. You know, these regulations have had quite a difficult history. These regulations that followed the adoption of the Family and Medical Leave Act have been attacked in various courts. United States Supreme Court in Ragsdale disallowed that part of the regulations that said unless an employer specifically designates the period of absence as FMLA leave, then FMLA leave is not running. Supreme Court said you can't do that. This court, I'm forgetting the name of the case now, but this court said the provision that says unless you respond to an application for FMLA leave by the date the leave is to begin with a determination that you're not entitled to the leave, you waive any objection to the leave. This court set that part of the regulations aside. The 11th Circuit followed this court in that regard. The 10th Circuit set aside that part of the regulations dealing with how you determine the situs of an employee's work. You have to have 50 employees within a 75-mile radius. There's an odd provision in the regulation that doesn't really focus on where the employee is assigned to work, but rather where the employee has been assigned out of to work.
None of that has anything to do with our case.
None of that other than it would not be a new event to find that the Department of Labor, in adopting this set of regulations, has repeatedly exceeded and, in fact, thwarted the intent of Congress.
The problem is you didn't attack the regulations in the district court, and so this argument has been forfeited and perhaps even waived because the regulations were argued, the applicability of the regulations were argued in the district court and were clearly in play, but there was no argument made that they were ultra-virus or invalid as against the statute. I know you're successor counsel here, but you're kind of stuck with that.
Well, Your Honor, this is a pure legal issue. Facts are not in dispute. It's a de novo standard in this court. The issue's been fully briefed. There's no prejudice to any side, and this court has in the past in Amcast and then in Rosser said in precisely these kinds of circumstances, and the Supreme Court has said in Singleton, that this court has the discretion to deal with this issue. No prejudice, no facts in dispute, pure legal question, and a de novo standard of review.
Well, of course, there is prejudice to the plaintiff if we take up the argument and deprive the plaintiff of the benefit of the procedural advantage that she otherwise has because of the forfeiture.
There's no question that if the court determines that in its discretion this needs to be relitigated, the court can certainly do that. But the court has the power.
But it's not a matter of being relitigated. You would lose and somebody else would bring the argument in a different case.
In a different case.
And, in fact, the exception that you've cited to the forfeiture rule, the discretionary consideration by the reviewing court in the event of a forfeiture doesn't apply if the argument has been waived. And that gets to my second point, which was that these regulations were in play in the district court litigation in this case. They were raised, they were argued in terms of their applicability, they were discussed, but the invalidity argument was not made. So why shouldn't we consider this argument to have been outright waived and not subject to the exception?
The reason, again, Your Honor, is because the case comes here in the same manner it would had the district court weighed in on the issue.
According to that rationale, then there never can be a waiver if we can always take up the matter.
And again, it's not an always situation. It's only when it's pure law, facts not in dispute, the parties have had a full opportunity, and this court has de novo review rather than clearly erroneous or...
That eliminates the distinction between forfeiture and waiver, counsel. My question goes to waiver. Do you acknowledge that the regulations were raised and argued so that there can only have been an intentional relinquishment of the right to make the invalidity argument?
The regulations were, in fact, argued, Your Honor, the fact that they did not apply to the circumstances of this case. Those were the only two arguments made. That because
so it wasn't, the regulations weren't overlooked.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. They were not overlooked. And the point of their validity was not raised in the district court. At the same time that the FMLA requires this 12-week period, it does not require an employer to provide paid sick leave, or for that matter, paid vacation or paid FMLA leave. There is an obligation to provide, though, this 12 work weeks. The substitution provision is in the statute to allow for those cases where an employer does choose to provide these other forms of paid leave. The Department of Labor regulations impose a limitation on the right of substitution of paid leave that's simply not in the statute. It can't be found in the statute. The insertion in the regulations that paid leave can only be designated or counted as FMLA leave if the FMLA leave is, quote, otherwise unpaid, which is what the regulations say, is out of whole cloth. It's simply nowhere. That qualifier narrows the employer's right, and for that matter, the employee's right, to substitute these paid leaves. The regulations then go further in narrowing the right of substitution by a broad definition of what is an otherwise paid FMLA leave, to include where an employee like Ms. Reppa receives an insurance benefit. So they transform the receipt of disability insurance benefits and call that the receipt of being on paid leave. Now, a construction of the regulations that would allow their validity, that would not challenge their validity, but would still require reversing the district court, would be the following. You read the regulations narrowly. So when they say an otherwise paid FMLA leave, you read it to mean where the employer is providing paid FMLA leave, not where an
employer... You're in your rebuttal time, you know that.
I'm sorry? Yeah, I understand that, Your Honor. Thank you very much. So you could read the regulation and not do damage to the employer's right of substitution by reading it to mean the employer must actually be paying FMLA leave. So in other words, the employee is out on FMLA leave, receiving regular pay, and the employer says, I'm also going to designate this leave as vacation leave and require you, in effect, to receive double pay during this period so that I can designate your vacation time as absent time under the FMLA. There's another provision in the regulation, I think, that was relied on by the district court that could be reconciled here with the right of substitution. And that's the provision that says if you're receiving, it starts out by saying if you are on leave as a result of the birth of a child and receiving disability insurance benefits, then there's no right of substitution. So it starts out with this specific on leave as a result of having a child, and then it goes to the general and says, if you're receiving disability benefits, no substitutions allowed. You could take that part of the regulation relied by the district court below and say that's confined to a situation where someone is on a FMLA leave as a result of the birth of a child, not the illness or accident of the employee herself or himself. Similarly, you could construe disability benefits provided by the employer to exclude the benefits provided here by a third party. And you could reconcile all of those regulations with the right of the employer to substitute in this case. And that would allow, I think it would certainly give effect to Congress's intent to not require an employer to both allow absence for 12 full weeks and additional weeks for paid sick leave and paid vacation. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Cobell.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, Kurt Cobell on behalf of Alice Reppa. We submit there are two issues before the court. The first is, should this court consider an attack on the validity of this regulation raised for the first time on appeal without the participation of the Department of Labor? The second issue is, did Congress intend for employees to be paid twice while on FMLA leave, once under a temporary disability plan and a second time with accrued vacation or sick leave? We submit both questions should be answered negatively. Now, with respect to the first issue, any review of the answer, the motion for summary judgment pleadings, and in the other documents below make it very clear that Roadway never attacked the validity of this regulation. Obviously, the seminal case to be cited in any such attacks is the Supreme Court's decision in Chevron. That case is never cited below to ascertain whether the regulation is, in fact, valid. Roadway's initial response was in its letter for its human relations vice president, Harrison, was that this regulation simply does not apply here because it's not Roadway's plan, it's the union's plan. And that's the argument Roadway asserted from the beginning and throughout the proceedings below. It's stuck with that argument. It cannot now, for the first time, raise this entirely new argument about whether the regulation itself is invalid. We recognize that there is some discretion here, but the court should not make any exception to this well-established principle of not considering these arguments raised for the first time here in the absence of the agency that promulgated the regulation. The Department of Labor's views would certainly be relevant to any attack on the validity of that regulation. The Department of Labor is not present in this case, and this court does not have the benefit of its views regarding this matter. Therefore, as
how would they be brought in at the trial level?
They could have intervened. They can appear as amicus in the court's decision in the Harrell versus Postal Service. The Department of Labor was permitted to argue as amicus in that case, involving an attack on an FMLA regulation. So that both the court as well as the Department of Labor as well as plaintiffs are all deprived of that basic protection of not permitting a party on appeal to raise a brand new argument. If however, the court does consider this argument, under a Chevron analysis, two questions must be answered. The first is the statute silent or ambiguous? And the second one is the agency's answer based upon a permissible construction of the statute. Certainly, the FMLA is silent and ambiguous regarding this issue. The statute uses the terms unpaid leave and paid leave, but nowhere does the statute define these terms. It's certainly appropriate for an agency to fill in the gaps in this fashion by defining statutory terms. The premise of the substitution rights provided in the Act is that the leave is unpaid. That raises a question, well, what if the leave is in fact not unpaid but paid through a temporary disability plan? And that's the question the Department of Labor answered in the regulations set forth in 825.207D. Chevron requires deferral to a reasonable interpretation by the agency charged with carrying out the act. There are two inquiries here. The first is, what is the agency's position? And the second one is this position a principled interpretation of the law? The DOL's position here is perfectly clear. Substitution rights don't apply where an employee is already receiving a form of paid leave in a temporary disability plan. Now, there are two forms of temporary disability payments. One is off-the-job injuries, and that's a temporary disability plan at issue here. A second form, and that's dealt with D1, 207 D1. The second form is dealt with under 207 D2, and that concerns an on-the-job injury, which is compensated by workers' compensation. Both forms of temporary disability raise precisely the same issue. They're both forms of unpaid leave, which the Department of Labor determined should preclude an employer from exercising substitution rights as well as precluding an employee from exercising those rights.
You know, the waiver notwithstanding, when you talk about the statute, it really does focus on leave and not benefit, it seems. And it looks like that when it talks about an employer may require an employee to substitute any of the accrued paid vacation leave, personal leave, or family leave of the employee for it seems that that is a power that is given. The question I asked other counsel, that if it takes, if this vacation leave is all used up and someone injures themselves on the last day of vacation, then that obviously couldn't apply. But on the other hand, the employer seems to at least have the discretion to require that substitution. And I recognize what these regulations, you know, how they conflict with that, but it just seems that's rather straightforward since we're on that argument.
Well, regarding the substitution right, states exactly that either the employer or the employee may exercise that right. But in applying that right to the multitude of circumstances, it's clear the statute didn't address this question, this kind of an anomaly here, Your Honor, about, well, what happens if the employee is already getting some income? Does that really serve the purposes of substitution? One of the purposes of substitution...
Well, it's a benefit to have that, surely, but it's not like they're being deprived of the money. It's a question of whether they're going to have the time.
Well, that's a problem, Your Honor, is in this situation here as applied to Ms. Ripa. She had, when she returned to work, she was off work for 6 weeks with this injury. She got income from that during that time period through her disability plan, $300 a week. She returns to work, and she's handed a check by her employer saying, here is your accrued vacation and sick time, too. If she, and that really deprives her of for the rest of that year, of any right to exercise her vacation time or if she's sick, whether it's an FMLA condition or a non-FMLA condition, to use her contractual sick leave during a period of time when she was already getting paid. Now, that can be abused in two respects. One is you might have an employee engage in what could be called double dipping. The employee can say, well, I'm not going to use my sick time, so I'm just going to get paid by this temporary disability plan, and on top of that, recover or use my sick leave, which I'll never use anyway. That's an abuse. By the same token, the employer can abuse it too by simply saying, in Ripa's situation, for example, well, I don't want Ripa to use her vacation. I'd rather have her working. So she's off on this temporary disability. Even though she's already getting income, I'm going to deprive her of her vacation by handing her a check when she comes back to work, and therefore I have her now for the rest of the year. She has no longer any vacation.
Well, I understand that policy argument. It's just the question of which way we're going to read into it. You say, well, it's maybe the statute's silent or isn't clear on that, but it does seem that this discretion is at least given to the employer. Yes, it's the employee also, of course, but obviously she wasn't going to exercise it.
Certainly, and the point is here is that the agency has seen fit to engage in what it's to fill in some gaps here for an issue that is not specifically addressed in the statute. And the court's inquiry is that a reasonable interpretation to address a void or an ambiguity? And as this court found in the Harrell versus the Postal Service case involving a similar situation where you had an ambiguity, is it a permissible interpretation by the expert agency? And the court answered that question, yes, and we submit the court should, applying that same analysis here, come to a similar conclusion. And certainly, the statute itself, there's arguments made that, well, the first sentence of the statute, if you parse this regulation, it's got four sentences. The first sentence refers to employees on a pregnancy disability leave. The second sentence refers to all temporary disability plans. So there's an instruction or a construction here of, well, doesn't this statute D1 apply only to a pregnancy disability leave, which is not the case here. I don't think that's a real viable or rational interpretation of that statute. The second sentence is clear. It applies to all plans. And if you look at the preamble to the regulation itself, it's pretty clear in the preamble that it's intended to apply to all types of plans covering temporary disabilities, whether provided through insurance or under a self-insured plan. That's from 60 FR 2206. So it's clear from the regulations that all plans are contemplated. D1 covers the temporary disability plan. D2 covers the workers' compensation situation. Finally, the argument that's made by the employer that, well, and this is the argument that's really before this court, and the only argument properly before this court made below is Roadway says, well, it's not my plan, so therefore the regulation doesn't apply. There's several flaws with that argument. The first is that if you look at, assuming the regulation is valid, D2 covers workers' compensation plans. Well, a workers' compensation plan is not the employer's plan. It's a third-party plan run by an insurance company. So under that regulation, it doesn't matter. And it really doesn't matter for purposes of this regulation where the employee gets the money from, whether it's from workers' compensation, whether it's from the employer's plan, or whether, in this case, it's from a plan that's really, we submit, it is the employer's plan. Because the employer has a collective bargaining agreement with the union, it chose through that collective bargaining agreement, instead of administering the plan itself, to delegate the administration of that particular benefit to a third party. And it's really not, the Wisconsin Health Fund is really not a third party. It is a Taft-Hartley fund in which is jointly administered by both the union and the employer. And as the employer, as a very large employer in this industry, Roadway certainly had the opportunity through selecting the trustees on that fund to influence the administration of that fund. So legally it's a separate fund, but in fact it is a fund that Roadway is not without an ability to influence.
And the employer contributes to the fund.
Absolutely.
And so the money came in that respect from the employer.
The employer pays solely to this fund. It's not as if the employee went out somewhere else and maintained some private disability plan. The employer paid for this fund and then consciously and deliberately chose to administer its fund that way. To accept their argument would really create an incentive for an employer to outsource its administration. Any employer, if you accept that argument, would simply say, okay, I'm just going to outsource my administration of this particular benefit to a third party and thereby escape this regulation because it's not nominally my plan. The fact of who controls the benefit is really irrelevant to the analysis, and it's not germane to the issue the Department of Labor was trying to get at by passing this regulation, which was, does it really make sense to apply a substitution right where the employee is getting a benefit? And that's the question properly addressed by the DOL, and we submit properly answered to say, no, where the employee is already getting a paid benefit, substitution rights should not apply. It's because it's not considered a form of unpaid leave. The Act contemplates unpaid leave, not paid leave. So for those reasons, we submit not only that the regulation is a proper exercise of the Department of Labor's authority, but that the court below properly interpreted this regulation as requiring Roadway to refrain from exercising its substitution rights here where Ms. Ripa was receiving benefits from a temporary disability plan as defined in 207 D1 of the regulations.
Thank you. Mr. DiNardo, do you have anything to add? You have a little less than a minute, I believe, a minute left.
Thank you, Your Honor. The statutory 12-week period clearly represents a legislative compromise. Part of that compromise was crediting an employer if that employer already provided paid time and it was accrued at the time the leave was requested. The employer has the obligation to return the employee to the position the employee left after the FMLA leave expires. The employee has the obligation to maintain health insurance. So this 12-week period is at the cornerstone of the Act. The Strickland case recognizes that stacking should not be permitted because that's not what Congress intended. There's no principled reason for a distinction in a case where an employee is receiving an insurance benefit and an employee is not receiving an insurance benefit. The right of substitution is absolute. The Act does contemplate that most employers will have unpaid FMLA leave, but it allows for the possibility of paid FMLA leave. That does not impinge on, in any way whatsoever, the employer's right of substitution in the four corners of the Act. Thank you.
I'll ask you one other thing, this waiver issue. Is there, you seem to acknowledge that this really wasn't challenged.
The validity was not challenged, Your Honor. I believe under Seventh Circuit and Supreme Court authority, this court has the total discretion to hear this matter. And I'd say it's appropriate in this case because it's been fully briefed and litigated. No one's been prejudiced.
Yeah, you said that.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This case will be taken under advisement.